Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. If you hear a good episode of the show, please do let someone know. Send them a WhatsApp. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's episode, the future of wearable tech. We're going to be talking about e-textiles and how the future is electronic when it comes to the clothes you wear. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the podcast. First up, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Dr. Tara Shine, environmental scientist, and Professor Matthew Campbell, head of department at the Smurfit Institute of Genetics at Trinity. You're both very welcome. Tara, our first story has to do with temperatures and births.
Yeah, so I knew about this from crocodiles, but I didn't realize that it also affected humans. And it is the effect of temperature on what the sex will be of the newborn. And there's been a big study done by the University of Oxford, and they have looked at 5 million births, so records of 5 million births from across 33 sub-Saharan African countries and India. And they basically found that higher temperatures mean fewer male births. So we're not talking about
at the time of conception, right? It's not like how hot the room is.
Not at the time of conception. And actually, they found a slight difference. So in both sub-Saharan Africa and India, they found that higher temperatures led to fewer male births, but the effects were different, or how it was caused was different. So in sub-Saharan Africa, when the higher temperature happens during the first trimester of pregnancy, then it's linked to a decline in male births. And there they found also that factors like lower levels of education, women living in rural areas and being further down the chain in a family, those were also factors that affected a decline in male births.
What?
Yeah.
Why would where you are in the family have an effect on whether or not you had a male child?
I think possibly because the mother is older at that point. That could be a factor. Maybe it's higher levels of stress because there's more kids and mouths to feed. But what it does mean is that temperature plus kind of socioeconomic vulnerability combined can mean lower levels of male births.
So if we're talking about the hottest time being, say, let's say, for example, June to late August, if the conception happens around May, June, then you're less likely to have a female baby.
Yeah. And I mean, this for me is interesting. I used to live in Mauritania, which is at the bottom edge of the Sahara Desert. And there you would have temperatures of 40 and 50 degrees in the months of May and June, for example. Yeah. And it is when temperatures are above 20 degrees that they start to associate fewer male births.
Does that correlation continue the hotter it gets? I mean, do you have even fewer babies when it's hotter?
That they didn't break that down. So what they did is they took large scale survey data of birth and overlaid that on high resolution temperature records. So I don't know yet to the extent to which they differentiated everything. They just said is when temperatures are above 20 degrees. But then when they compared sub-Saharan Africa to India, what's interesting there is that the effects appear later in pregnancy. So their higher temperatures during the second trimester were associated with fewer male births. And there they found that older mothers, which could be again linked to this higher birth order, which is being like the sixth or seventh child rather than the first child.
Right.
That also had an effect on reducing the number of male births. But this is bad news because with climate change, obviously, sub-Saharan Africa is getting warmer, India is getting warmer, and people are becoming more vulnerable socioeconomically. And so the combination of those factors could skew, our populations and the gender balance within populations over time.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't the natural ratio 51% male to 49 at the moment? And that kind of evens out by the time men and women get to 18 because men are more likely to die before they reach adulthood, both because of risky behavior and other factors to do with war and violence and so on. And so As the world becomes more peaceful, but actually that is not what's happening, is it?
I think it evens out globally, but not within countries. So in countries where there is a preference for sons, and where there is already a skewed population because of a preference for sons, it isn't actually the case that in every country it is 51-49.
And there is a risk in
this that it will become skewed. And that's where the crocodiles become interesting again, which is where I had learned first about how temperature affected the sex of offspring. Because there, actually, in crocodiles, there isn't a balance between male and females. There's always more females than males. And crocodiles have not gone extinct over millions and millions and millions and millions of years. So I'm not sure what that means for humans, but maybe it means that we may be able to have some resilience to a lack of gender balance in our overall population.
Someone say less men is actually a much brighter future. But anyway, we'll move on.
We won't go into that.
Yeah. Matthew, our second story has to do with engineered moths. What is this about?
So every year we use a lot of animal models in preclinical research. If you wanted to, you know, bring a drug to clinical trial or to develop new drugs, you need to use preclinical models. Those models are normally mice or rats, and in some circumstances, non-human primates, larger animals. But every time we use a mouse in a study, we have to consider, is there an alternative? It's called the three R's. It's replacement, refinement, and reduction. So we're licensed to work with these animals as long as we address these three R's. So is there an alternative? And in some cases, there are alternatives. So people will try to look for different model organisms that we could potentially use to give us the same signal of efficacy, that a drug is working and it may translate into a drug for humans. So what this particular study was doing was it was exploring an insect-based model. So a moth. Was there a way that moths could be genetically modified to see whether or not we could use them as a really, really robust model to translate into human disease?
Wow. I mean, insects are very different to mammals.
They're very, very different. But there are some commonalities in certain areas of research where they're really useful. So for things like response to fungal infection, bacterial infection, viral infection, they're such primitive responses that we have, because obviously we needed them evolutionarily very, very early on, that a lot of those processes are conserved in small animals as well as larger animals. So for work like, you know, exploring novel therapeutics or novel treatments for bacterial resistance or fungal resistance, they're quite a good model. The caveat has always been, though, that we haven't been able to genetically modify moths. Okay, so we've a concept in genetics where we talk about vertical gene transfer. Okay, so vertical gene transfer is if you have kids, you're able to pass on your genes to your kids. So we all have 50-50. So we've got 50% of your mum's genes, 50% of your dad's genes. That's called vertical transfer. But a number of years ago, decades ago, we discovered this process called horizontal gene transfer, where you can take a gene from one species and put it into another species. So really kind of exciting science fiction-y type concepts. The idea here is that what they did was they decided to use a reporter gene, so a gene that's only found in a jellyfish called green fluorescent protein. So if you shine blue light on a jellyfish, it glows green because it has this gene that produces a protein called GFP. And what this group did was they took the GFP gene and put it into the moth, and all of a sudden they had fluorescent moths. And that's really important, because if you're able to do that in a single species, you can start playing around with genes and figure out, you can use this GFP as a label to know when genes are being switched on or when genes are being switched off.
Wow.
And if those genes are really critical for bacterial response or fungal response, hey presto, you can use these moths as a model to tell you exactly what's happening if you infect the creatures with a fungus or a bacteria or a virus. So very powerful technology, and the first evidence that this smaller animal could be used. So, you know, that's completely addressing the three R's. It's amazing.
And no one cares about insects.
Well, they're smaller species. If you're sitting around a campfire and one of these guys flew into your face, you'd
get rid of it.
You'd get rid of it.
Yeah, you'd get rid of it. Yeah. No, I mean, all joking aside, obviously mammals, you know, you don't want to be using mammals for a number of different reasons. And moths have a shorter lifespan, are much easier to breed, are much cheaper.
Much cheaper. Bed and breakfast for a mouse in Dublin is very expensive.
Our third story has to do with horses.
Yes, and I have to admit, on this one, I did call a friend. I called two horsey friends to understand the communication of horses, because this study is all about how we now know that a horse's whinny, which I now know is the same as a neigh, is made up of two sounds, a high-pitched sound and a low-pitched sound. And whilst people knew already where the low-pitched sound came from, it was a vibration of air in the voice box of the horse. The high-pitched sound was a mystery.
You're talking about the high-pitched bit, they didn't know where that came from.
Yeah, because did you know that horses also whicker or nicker? Did you know that?
No, what's that?
No, this is fascinating.
Come on, do it. I did the whinny. You have to do the knicker.
A whicker or a knicker is like a low-pitched little shuffly gentle noise. And a horse makes that if he recognizes you and knows that you're the person with the food. Then it's like, oh, I like you, bring me the food.
What does it sound like, Tara?
I can't do it.
Come
I'm not
on.
Do
is it,
it
like a shh? Is that sort of a thing? No, different.
No, you're going to have to look it up. But anyway,
people listening to this are going, would you just get on with the story? Sorry, my apologies.
Get on with the story. Yeah, well, and whinny or a neigh, on the other hand, is a really, really loud noise. And whilst some people say that horses make this noise when they're happy and we hear them a lot in movies, actually, they're more when they're unhappy, when a friend is being taken away or they're being separated, like a mother and foal, for example. But anyway, apparently, this lady, Elodie Mandel Briefer, was interested enough in a horse's whinny or neigh that she decided to kind of look into it more closely. And this high-pitched sound, they couldn't figure out. And it turns out it actually is more like a whistle than anything else. But it's a whistle developed kind of in the voice box of the horse. And that whistle is also found, that mechanism for making this high-pitched noise, is the same as we find in rats and mice. But horses are the first large mammal that are known to make this noise. And interestingly, like wild Przewalski horses, they make the noise and elks make the noise, but donkeys and zebras don't. I do find it fascinating that somebody was even kind of, I just don't know how you come up with the idea to decide that you're going to do a study and get funded to do a study on horses.
I hear. That's, I mean, I've heard way crazier studies than that. Matthew, our final story has to do with where our eyes came from.
So it starts off with where our eyes came from, but it kind of converges on a thing called the pineal gland, which we sometimes call our third eye. So if I was to take a scan of your brain now, right in the very, very center of your brain is a small gland called the pineal gland. And this wasn't actually a paper, it was a review article. So it was an opinion piece of these guys in Sweden, sort of looking back in the literature and thinking, I wonder where this came from an evolutionary basis. And what they have sort of posited is that these swamp-like creatures, basically they were sitting in swamps, that they had light-sensitive cells. So there was...
We're talking millions and millions and millions and
600
billions
of years ago, so a long time ago. There were these swamp-like creatures sitting in swamps, right? Really, really shallow water and you know, wasn't moving very much, that they had these two primitive eyes, which were basically light-sensitive cells, that ultimately they didn't need two eyes because they weren't, you know, they weren't being predated upon. They were pretty happy and safe. So the two eyes kind of merged, the two concepts of these cells merged and formed one single light-sensitive body. And that concept was that then gave rise to what we termed the pineal gland, this third eye. And the most interesting thing about the pineal gland, even though it's in the middle of our brain, it's light sensitive. So if I was to crack open your skull, peel apart your brain and shine light on it, this body in the middle of our brain actually would respond to light. And it's really interesting, in smaller vertebrates like zebrafish, small tiny little fish, if you shine light on the surface of their heads, you can actually get an electrical response from their pineal gland. Its role in humans is that it regulates circadian rhythms. So there's a direct connection from your retina at the back of the eye to the pineal gland, and it produces melatonin. So people will have heard of melatonin. You take your tablets if you're going traveling abroad, and it kind of regulates your circadian rhythms when light is light and when dark is dark. So it was kind of an opinion piece on where that came from, that we kind of originated from this cyclops-like creature in the swamp 600 million years ago, and that gave rise to the pineal gland. Because we have to think about the retina at the back of the eye, that it's light sensitive, but the retina is very different from the type of cells that produce light and cause and give rise to eyes in insects. That eye that an insect has is derived from skin cells. Okay, the retina is derived from brain cells. The retina is part of the brain. So they perform the same function. They're both light sensitive, but are they really, can we call them both the same type of thing? Probably not, because their origin is very, very different.
Wow, I'd never realised that. Yeah. I didn't realise our eyes were so completely different from insect eyes.
Yep.
Thank you very much, Professor Matthew Campbell and Dr. Tara Shine. Thank you very much. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us science@newstalk.com. Now, imagine a world where your t-shirt tracks your health, your socks help prevent injury, and your bandage doesn't just cover a wound, it actually helps to heal it. At the University of Southampton, researchers are building a future where wearable tech isn't strapped to you, it's just what you wear. Joining me now is Professor Steve Beebe. He's a chair in immersion technologies and director of the Center for Flexible Electronics and E-Textiles. Hi, Steve. Let's start off talking about electronic textiles as a concept. This has been around for a while. I mean, we've talked about it on the program, but as technology progresses on lots of different levels, we're getting to a very cool stage. But when did this idea come about?
Yeah, you're right. It kind of started with a hobbyist approach sort of 25, 30 years ago, with people taking conventional like PCBs that were designed to be sewn onto a fabric using conductive thread. And that's great for, like I say, just doing that at home with, you know, very predefined sort of circuit boards, but not practical at all. And over the time, over the 25 years, yeah, the technology's advanced and we're working towards sort of invisibly integrating the electronics into the fabric.
Why do we need electronic clothing?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it's essentially a platform technology for wearables. And when we think wearables, we automatically think of the smartwatch. But you are constraining yourself to the location of the watch. And it does a lot of its sensing, and the readings it takes are inferred. So with e-textiles, we can actually sense, for example, ECG. We can do a proper ECG measuring the electrical signals on the chest, rather than inferring that from a sensor reading taken at the heart, which is actually measuring the pulse. So there's lots of advantages to doing specific things in the correct locations on the body. And also, you know, if we don't have to wear a watch, we can engage with our wearable tech just by getting dressed in the morning. That's quite convenient.
What are the other advantages of this sort of technology?
So it does give you that performance advantage. So if you are measuring things at the correct location on the body, you get much greater improved quality of data. And by integrating things around the body within the same garment, for example, we can do much more things. So your smartwatch can track your steps, but with smart clothing, we could actually monitor how you're moving exactly. So how your arms are moving. We could do something for virtual reality type applications or medical applications, rehabilitation, for example.
Yeah. The whole body data that's personal to you is a real goldmine for technology companies in particular, who are trying to create a very holistic, personalized health and wellness ecosystem, right? Because that wearable tech has just absolutely exploded over the last few years. And as you say, it's not just about, you know, monitoring things like your heartbeat or your how much you sweat, but it can also identify perhaps something that might be going wrong. So if you're walking differently, your gait can tell a lot about how healthy you are, the speed at which you walk, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Or we can get early warning. For example, if people are becoming increasingly unstable over time, then rather than, you know, waiting for a fall to happen for the elderly, we can actually get early warning that people are becoming unstable. We can do things around the house, for example, to reduce the risk. So yeah, there's lots and lots of applications like that.
And so where are we with this idea? Like, how advanced is the tech? Does it give us the ability to, for example, you know, power the devices and sensors that we need just by wearing something and walking around using that kinetic energy idea that came around in watches a few decades ago?
Yeah, you know, people are in the research domain. We are looking at that sort of thing, but that's a way away yet.
Is it?
Yeah. So at the moment, we can integrate. We take a fairly pragmatic approach of putting flexible electronics. So the sort of circuits you have inside your watch, doing that in a flexible way and embedding that within the garment and hiding it as best we can. Things like the power supply and the battery and the wires, etc., they are still an issue in terms of hiding the technology. That's probably one of the biggest bugbears for the technology.
Right. So if I'm wearing a coat, I'll still need some sort of pocket that carries some sort of battery if I want to have any functionality still.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, you can't wash the battery. You have to remove it. So you have to have a connector, et cetera. And it's just, it goes against that vision of embedding it all invisibly, if you like, and keeping it easy.
Yeah. I mean, there are, There are different ways to shape batteries, though, aren't there? I mean, can you distribute the battery across a wide surface and make it flexible, or do you still need to take it out? I guess that's the problem.
So, well, the pragmatic approach at the moment is to take it out and just use what looks like a conventional sort of, you know, top battery topping up thing for your phone, sort of portable charger. But yeah, we are actually turning the textile itself into batteries at the moment. So we have that in the lab at the moment. We could turn any textile into a battery.
Wow.
The challenge is making that practical, making it survive washing, making it, you know, survive flexing and bending, etc.
So how do you turn fabric into a battery?
Well, fabric actually is a really good scaffold for a battery. So a battery has a separator that goes between the anode and the cathode, and you can use the textile as the separator and deposit your battery electrodes on the surfaces of the textile. And yeah, you then add the electrolyte, etc., and then you've got a battery. The challenge is encapsulating all that and doing it in such a way it's flexible and thin. It doesn't alter the feel of the textile too much. So we're kind of looking at that technology now, working with guys in chemistry on the battery chemistries, etc. And it's really cool work. It will happen. Again, it's one of these things that's a few years away.
Because the circuits themselves, getting circuits in the sort of compute power, that's not difficult at all, right? Because I when I was in Japan maybe 8 years ago, they had this computer printer, and it would just print out circuits on a piece of paper. It was amazing. It was just like you print out, you know, your Word document, it would just print out electrical circuits. So the circuits presumably aren't the problem. It's dealing with the day to day of movement that will break those circuits or connect the cathode and the diode, essentially rendering the battery useless. Right. That's the real trick.
Yeah, you're right. So there's lots of ways we can integrate the electronics, the circuits. But it is that as a system, the assembly and the surviving of that, of the rigors of use, we call it. So typically the machine washing environment is incredibly robust. You know, it's a physical battering process. Textiles are brilliant. You know, they can be engineered to be wonderfully soft and comfortable, but also stop a bullet. The electronics have to survive everything that the textile survives. Yeah, and that's the challenge. Yeah.
What sort of companies are looking at this? And I'm just trying to figure out what are we likely to see first? Because understanding, I suppose, what's going on in your body is useful, but we, you know, as you say, you do get pretty good information from a watch. You know, if you're going to get something that is really usable and worthwhile, it has to be that much better. Are there companies, you know, commercial companies really interested in developing this sort of technology, and what do they see as being the key differences between this and, you know, just being able to use a watch?
Yeah, so there are companies working on medical applications and health and fitness applications. Health and fitness is a bit easier because of less regulations required. So these are the first to market sort of applications. And here, you know, they're measuring things like muscle activity. So measuring your EMG signals whilst training, which gives you more information than you can get, just from the watch, for example. So they're the sort of examples. The medical ones, then they're quite, it depends on the application, but there are lots of ones around, for example, ECG monitoring and things like that, and sweat sensing, for example, and things like that, looking at the analytes in sweat.
You can imagine elite sport would be an obvious one, where you really want to be able to measure things in high resolution to understand what's going on in the body and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a really good example of a motion capture suit that has about 15, I think, IMU, these inertial measurement units, these sensors that monitor your motion around the whole body. And that looks at the technique of a golfer's swing. And it captures it in great detail. And there's a lot of data analytics and data visualization behind that. And that enables a golfer and his coach to kind of analyze a swing.
Yeah.
Yeah. From wherever they're on the world. The coach can be on the other side of the world and look at the players. Data, etc.
Yeah, if you ever see someone score and get a yellow card for taking their shirt off these days, you'll often notice that the football player in question is wearing a reverse looking bra, and that I imagine is just annoying to have to wear You know, rugby players, I think, have a pack at the back of their at the middle of their back. If I remember correctly, and obviously senses in the balls or whatever.
Yeah.
But they look cumbersome, like that bra thing. The idea of playing at my very best, you know, fast and comfortable and in tune with my body, then to have this bloody thing, you know, to measure, you know, player distance and running and all those sort of things that are useful to know, that seems like a key area of interest. What about the general public? Is there, I mean, have you done market research to understand, do people want this sort of thing? I mean, apart from the benefits of you know, being able to sense, would it mean that your phone would last forever, for example, or you could charge smartwatches? And are people comfortable with that idea?
Yeah, we don't really target public applications, as it were, personal applications, because you know, you've got to have a spot on reliable, you know, you don't want to be dealing with returns and things that don't work, etc. So it's nowhere near that at the moment. But, you know, in the past, you could buy your T-shirts that lit up if you were in Wi-Fi range. You know, you'd get like the electroluminesce and light up depending on the Wi-Fi signal, things like that. But they weren't great. They were quite, the printed lighty up bits were quite rigid and stiff and everything. And they didn't feel great. Consumer applications, it's got to be spot on, and it's got to be something that I think they don't notice. And it's doing something that's ideally useful. We don't really want to be, I don't feel like we should be integrating electronics for fast fashion applications to change the appearance of the garment and things like that. That doesn't feel right, because people then just throw these things away, and it's not great for sustainability. But
that won't stop some people from doing it.
No, you're right. Absolutely,
Let's talk a little bit about the other applications, this sort of smart sensor, low energy technology. So I mentioned in the intro that you're looking at smart bandages. What do they look like and how do they work?
So the smart bandages just include some pretty simple electronics that monitor the heat or the temperature of the wound. So if a wound is becoming infected, the temperature raises. And what's clever about our particular smart bandage is it also has ultraviolet LEDs incorporated in it. And if your wound is infected, the UV light will kill bacteria and viruses.
Wow.
So it's called ultraviolet germicidal irradiation. It's very well known. It's used for air purification, water purification, etc. But we're using it, incorporating it into a bandage for the purposes of treating infected wounds. And that can potentially reduce the reliance on antibiotics, for example.
Wow. That's very cool. And where is that along the clinical journey? I mean, have you done animal testing or what's the next step?
We've done lab testing on bacteria, so a variety of different bacteria, to prove that you can kill the bacteria. Mm. And we've looked at the influence of the actual bandage. You know, we want to separate the electronics from the wound in terms of the electronics have to be removable. So when you throw away the bandage, you take the electronics and put it on another bandage, but then you're shining the light through the bandage. So we're looking at how the light is affected by the different bandages, etc. We're not at a stage yet where we're putting this on animals or people, but we'll see how that goes. And who knows what happens in the future with that?
Yeah, that's a really cool idea. Any other applications of this sort of low energy powered devices that are wearable?
Another thing we're looking at is another medical application is skin sensing for monitoring people with atopic dermatitis. So at the moment, it's a very it is subjective in terms of it's a questionnaire. So people give their feedback on how the condition is based on a sort of standardized questionnaire. And we're developing a textile-based sensor that can actually quantify the condition and the severity of any flares and breakouts of atopic dermatitis or eczema. So that's a nice little project. We are applying that to patients at the hospital here at Southampton, so we're getting data from patients, and we know we can detect, you know, the atopic dermatitis flare-ups, etc. So we are looking at ways of expanding that and seeing if we can do that in the home as a sort of early telehealth example of any textile sensor. So, yeah.
So what is the final hurdle then to be overcome? You're talking about, you know, the ability to withstand washing in a machine. Are there any other bottlenecks in terms of technology, the size, the weight, the power demands that prevent you from making this? Or is that the one thing, is the ability to withstand a washing machine cycle?
No, I think if I could get rid of the battery reliably or integrate the battery invisibly within the textile and may that survive washing, that would radically improve the technology.
Right.
But the moment you can hide the electronics, but you know, you show it to someone and there's a big lumpy battery, and it kind of ruins all the demos and things.
If
we can get rid of that, I think the technology will have a step change in adoption.
Well, the best of luck with it. Thanks for joining us. Professor Steve Beebe is from the University of Southampton, working with eTextiles. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
All right, it's time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we were talking about predicting scorpion strikes with Michel Dugon from the University of Galway. He has a venom systems lab there. He was showing us his scorpions and telling us how you can identify which scorpions are more dangerous by the soil, which I thought was quite interesting. Ron says, very interesting. Any new theories as to why scorpions glow under UV light? That's from Ron on Facebook. Can I be honest with you, Ron, I didn't know that. Did that come up? I don't think it came up in the program. I have no idea. Mick on Facebook says, always a good show. Today was pretty interesting. Thanks for that, Mick. And we posted a video of Michelle showing off his scorpions. Mary says, interesting and incredibly terrifying in one. It's an interesting character. I want to go to Morocco. I want to check out these scorpions. That's what I want to do. We were also speaking to Iris Muller. She's a professor at Trinity College Dublin. We're talking about tides and waves. And someone said, I wonder how might advances in satellite observation or drone technology improve our understanding of tidal wave dynamics? I actually wonder how we can observe that now, because there are instruments that measure down to the millimeter Earth movements, but I don't know if any of the instruments on, say, the Copernicus satellites that the European Space Agency launched a few years ago, I don't know if any of them actually monitor something as dynamic as a wave. I must find that out. But yeah. It would be interesting. It's just a lot of data would be my worry, because, you know, how much of the ocean would you need to monitor to be able to get something useful and do that by space? I mean, I'm trying to figure it out in my head, but I don't have an answer for you, I'm afraid. That's it from us on this week's episode. Marisa Sullivan is producing, Rory Galvin's on podcast, and Hugo De Silva's on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae. Proudly supported by Research Ireland. Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.